You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. My name is Barbara, by Barbara Streisand. Hello, Enormous. Of course, Barbara Streisand's memoir, 10 years in the making, if you don't count the chapters she scribbled in longhand in the 1990s and then lost, was going to approach power broker proportions. For one thing, she is, fits of insecurity notwithstanding, a bona fide power broker, tearing down barriers to and between Broadway, Hollywood, the recording industry, and Washington, D.C., like Robert Moses on a demolition bender. For another, as Streisand writes in My Name is Barbara, a 970-page victory lap past all who ever doubted, diminished, or dissed her, with lingering high fives for the many supporters, she does tend to agonize over the editing process. After adding back material to her version of A Star is Born for Netflix in 2018, I think I made it better. But did I? I'm never quite sure. She fantasized about new, fuller cuts of both Funny Girl, which made her a movie star on arrival, and Yentl, her debut as director. Planning her wedding to the actor James Brolin in 1998, she tried to winnow down a long list of desserts before deciding, we'll just have them all. Why not? It doesn't take a psychiatrist, though Streisand, 81, has consulted many, played one in The Prince of Tides, and even incorporated the therapeutic framework into one concert tour to figure out why she has taken such a big bite out of life. As recounted before in a flotilla of biographies, none authorized, and at least one tell-all by an early roommate who was promptly ghosted, she grew up deprived both economically and emotionally in a housing project in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Instead of a doll, she carried a hot water bottle. I swear it felt more like a real baby than some cold doll, for which a sympathetic neighbor knitted a pink hat and sweater. Such details may be familiar to fans, but for the most part they ring out more resoundingly in Streisand's chatty, ellipsis-strewn telling. She may possess megawatt fame, a hollow trophy, she assures us, but between these covers she's just Bubby Barbara at a kitchen table, talking about fabrics and fellows who got fresh, and my first fur coat sold to me as Zarina, a.k.a. Alaskan Sable, but in reality, skunk. Her father, an educator from an Orthodox Jewish background, died at 35 after a head injury when Barbara, as they spelled it back then, was 15 months old, and her brother was 9. She still has her father's copy of Tales from Shakespeare for Children on her bedside table. Who knows? Maybe he had bought it to read to me. Her mother remarried a man named Kind, who was anything but, gave birth to another little girl, and had distinct Madame Rose undertones, crooning into a broomstick microphone, and so forth. Where are my presents? She screamed at a Christmas gathering in 1964, by which time her older daughter had released the top 40 hit People and appeared thrice in Vogue. I'm the mother. She's nothing without me. That the film rights to Gypsy have slipped from Streisand's grasp after a prolonged tease seems one of showbiz's prosecutable crimes. She even gobbles egg rolls, Mr. Goldstone. Another, this book, which is adorned with more boldface names than there were sequins on the Arnold Scassi pantsuit she wore to the Oscars in 1969, has no index. You kind of want to resurrect Spy magazine to make one, as it did for the Andy Warhol diaries. Little Barbara suffered from undiagnosed tinnitus, possibly a bug God planted in her ear, urging her to run the hell away from her family's dysfunction. She vowed to become a performer after seeing Susan Strasberg, the method guru Lee's daughter, in The Diary of Anne Frank at the Court Theater, later contriving a meeting with Strasberg Sr., who didn't intimidate her in the slightest. He reminded me of my Uncle Irving. She also was swooning at the movies near Erasmus Hall High, where she was an honors student. Her schoolmate, Bobby Fischer, the future chess prodigy, looked like some sort of deranged pilot from a 1940s movie, she presently noted. Streisand collected mentors who introduced her to books and records and scratched up the money for classes in acting, pantomiming at Chocolate Chip, and reading from Medea. Why have you made me a girl? Though she hates to fly, she longed to escape, and she would become an expert crisscrosser of centuries and cultures on screen. But it was her shimmery, almost woolly, intuitive singing, first at a gay bar and then at the Bonsoir Supper Club in Greenwich Village, that would first dazzle the public. She found the spotlight warm and comforting, quickly lopped off that second A from her first name, and reminds us now that the second S in Streisand is soft, telephoning Tim Cook to get the pronunciation corrected on Siri. The author salts My Name is Barbara, the title recycled from her 1965 TV special that itself cribbed the name of a Leonard Bernstein song, with Yiddishisms, tchotchkes, she likes pig ones, Goneth, or Thief, her ex-boyfriend John Peters, and Fakakta, what her then-agent David Begelman called the Isaac Bashevis singer short story that was the basis for Yentl. Then there are the generous dollops of chutzpah. Besides sassing Strasberg, she somehow managed to resist all the advisors who told her to bob her long nose, ditch the thrift store clothes, and choose more standard numbers than, say, Harold Arlen's A Sleeping Bee, with lyrics by Truman Capote. Nobody put Barbara in a corner. She clashed early with the prickly playwright and director Arthur Lawrence, insisting she perform the secretary Miss Marmelstein's eponymous solo in I Can Get It For You Wholesale from a swivel chair. You're never going to make it, you know, he snarled at her. Never, though the audience went wild for the sequence. They'd reunite later on the massively successful picture The Way We Were. A lot of men seemed to resent her drive. I have more talent in my farts than you have in your whole body, Walter Matthau told her on the set of Hello, Dolly. Mike Wallace called her totally self-absorbed and made her cry on 60 Minutes. But many more fell at her feet, including Marlon Brando, who rubbed them. The King of England had sipped constant comment from her cup. Paul Conroy, the Prince of Tides author, compared her to the goddess Athena. Athena on Conroy's dancing. Boy, he could really fling that tush around. Stephen Sondheim rewrote lyrics for her. Tabulating all the boyfriends and admirers might require a second index. I thought we were going to have an affair, the married Mandy Patinkin tearily implored her during Yentl, she writes. Though she has a reputation for being controlling, basically the definition of being a director, Streisand here stresses convincingly, if somewhat exhaustively, her spontaneity. Contra Ethel Merman, who famously declared herself Miss Birdseye when presented with new lyrics in rehearsals of Call Me Madam, she believes to freeze something is to kill it. She wanted to print the words, this is a work in progress, on the back of her 1976 Leader album. Glenn Gould loved it, an example of her dogged refusal to stay in one lane. Come to think of it, I should put it on this book, too. Future editions, then, might excise some of the long block quotes of praise from her peers, like the one purportedly from Tennessee Williams, collected by an interviewer whose veracity was questioned by Helen Shaw in The New Yorker. Not to get too Lawrence about it, but Streisand maybe could have used a trusted collaborator, a J.R. Moringer or even a J.J. Hunsecker, to rein in some indulgences, like long lists of bold-faced friends at later career concerts. There is something exuberant and glorious, though, about Streisand's photo dump of self-portraits and party pics. Indeed, about this whole dragged-out banquet of a book. You might not have the appetite to linger for the whole thing, but you'll find something worth a nosh. There are just so many scintillating Streisands to contemplate over so many years. Singer, actress, director, producer, philanthropist, activist, lover, mother, wife, friend, autobiographer. I would make a very good critic, she suggests at one point, and as I struggle to put a button on this, All I can reply is, Barbara, be my guest. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs, who is a book critic and the author of Still Here, The Madcap, Nervy, Singular Life of Elaine Stritch. The Fund, Ray Dalio, Bridgewater Associates, and the Unraveling of a Wall Street Legend by Rob Copeland. Ray Dalio is the titan behind the world's biggest hedge fund, a deep thinker and confidant of some of Earth's most powerful people. Now 74, he has worked diligently over the past few years to publicize his principles, perhaps in the hope that his name will live on. In the fund, Rob Copeland has done him the favor of assuring that it will, attached to one of the pettiest bullies you'll ever meet on the page. This is a terrific dagger of a book, packed with cringy detail, just long enough to efficiently disembowel its subject. Most of The Fund doesn't feel like a book about finance. Instead, it is about how a man of surpassing mediocrity used money to control and humiliate, and how much people abase themselves for it, which, come to think of it, makes it one of the better books ever written about Wall Street. The early chapters cover Dalio's rise from middle-class striver to captain of finance, a journey begun, in time-honored fashion, by caddying at the local golf club. The links proved an excellent place to cultivate a talent for a sycophanty, and Dalio was taken under the wing of a well-connected family. After business school and gaining visibility by boldly predicting an impending depression, Dalio eventually got a fund off the ground, Bridgewater, that promised to invest clients' money safely. This looming depression, always imminent, has never come. But by regularly forecasting economic downturns, he has gotten credit for anticipating a few. He had a successful stretch of investing through the 1990s and into the 2000s, and in the wake of the 2008 crash, his hedge fund became the single largest in the world. Thus, Dalio was able to turn to his true life's work, subjecting the 1,600-odd people who worked for him to ever more baroque and dystopic psychological manipulations. This is roughly where Copeland, now a reporter at the New York Times, jumps in. Some of the Bridgewater Panopticon story has been told before, notably by Copeland himself. But even if you think you've already heard everything about this crazy hedge fund that videotapes employee interactions so they can critique one another under the flag of radical transparency, know this, there is so much more. To anticipate the full impact of the Connecticut struggle sessions, you'll need a little bit of jargon. For much of Bridgewater's history, every employee has received a baseball card with ratings of their abilities or character, to which their colleagues contribute. And contributing ratings, or dots, is itself a key metric. There are rewards handed out to bullies and informants. You might think that the result of this system would be a wholesome cycle of self-improvement through honesty and informed introspection. But oddly, the outcome is a climate of paranoia and punishment that comes down hardest on the weakest. There was, for instance, the incident of the wrinkled peas in the cafeteria, in which a written complaint whipped the vegetables into pristine shape. There was the time when the parking staff was fired for designing parking passes deemed too big. When Dalio noticed a spill on the floor by his urinal, Copeland writes, he summoned a deputy to investigate. But for the most part, it has always been safer to be a lower-level drone than in Dalio's direct orbit. Seemingly, the higher employees rise, the more compromised they become. James Comey, who served as Dalio's security chief before his stint as FBI director, received around $7 million a year. Among other things, Copeland relates, he was given the task of investigating a young woman's risque messages. Once, he allegedly left a private binder out to catch low-level employees reading it. Yet no degree of servility has been quite enough to save anyone from ritual humiliation. If an employee fails at an impossible mission, or is found to have lied about some small point of personal behavior, Dalio's strategy has been to call for a probe in front of their co-workers. In the case of the most serious perceived transgressions, these have turned into full-on trials. As Copeland reports, in several of these instances, the employee subjected to Dalio's browbeating started sobbing. Naturally, the sessions are recorded so that people in the company might learn from them. Dalio asks his minions for honest feedback, including on his own performance. He does not often get it, of course. Paul McDowell, tasked with designing the principal's operating system, Copeland writes, assigned an underling to go into the software and program a new rule. Dalio himself would be the new baseline for believability in virtually all important categories. As the original topmost believable person at Bridgewater, Dalio's rating was now numerically bulletproof to negative feedback. Regardless of how everyone else in the firm rated him, the system would work to keep him on top. The careful reader might wonder how a place that seems to devote almost all its energies to competitive flagellation still makes money. Traditionally, hedge fund managers make money with a formula of 2 and 20. 2% of the money under management plus 20% of the profits over some kind of benchmark. Think of Dalio as the king of the 2%ers. For the past decade, the actual returns of Bridgewater have been mediocre at best. It is still the biggest hedge fund in the world, with investors continuing to put their money into a known name. And with some $125 billion under management, the fees it takes in keep Dalio on the leaderboards of the world's billionaires. There is one point in the book in which Dalio is publicly questioned by an employee at a Bridgewater town hall and reverts to the wealthy guy's ultimate retort, "If you're so smart, why aren't you rich?" One of the peculiarities of Dalio's story is that he just doesn't come off as very smart at all. His predictions have been wrong as often as right, and as the years passed, Dalio's advantage softened, then seemingly ceased. The rise of powerful computers made it easy for any trader to program rules and to trade by them. Confronted with differing views, he has resisted change. But Dalio is the boss, and he is rich. And if there is any question, Dalio could win every argument by having his assistants send out an instant poll to employees' iPads, which overwhelmingly revealed him to be right. Wall Street makes an excellent background for portraits of ordinary human failing. The numbers mean a vast canvas, the stakes high enough that people will accept an astonishing level of humiliation. But Dalio's basic type is familiar in any enterprise. The manager who made the most of good luck by judiciously kissing up thinks his job is mainly kicking down and sits on top of a machine that hums along on its own. For anyone who has had an awful boss, the fund is the perfect rage read. One especially telling scene recounts how, on leaving the firm, a sub-chieftain was presented by Dalio with a special gift, a lucite-encased copy of his baseball card, memorializing all his poor ratings. "The best gift anyone can receive," Dalio told his honoree, "is knowledge of their own weaknesses." If so, Dalio will appreciate the chance to read Copeland's book with care. Somehow, it doesn't seem likely that he'll be sending a thank you. This review was written by Mark Gimeon, who is an editor at The Week. The Eden Test by Adam Sternberg. A woman surprises her husband with a week-long couples retreat in The Eden Test, Adam Sternberg's new thriller. Threat shimmers around their isolated cabin, though one suspects that nothing would force them to endure anything more painful than a week of working on the relationship. On their first date 3 years earlier, Daisy licked a smudge of creme brulee off Craig's chin, a mischievous gesture that bound them together. They spent weekends together eating croissants and reading the paper, its sections unfurled all around them like blueprints for some brazen upcoming heist. The Eden Test shows how a couple in love can seem like a two-person army, fugitives from the outside world. As the novel's epigraph from Adam Phillips puts it, a couple in a conspiracy in search of a crime. Now Daisy and Craig appear less like co-conspirators than adversaries. The denim overalls that Craig used to strip off Daisy have become those expletive overalls she always wears, and Daisy is clear-eyed about Craig's failings, from his infidelities to his pretension about restaurants, as though he'd studied in the finest culinary schools of Europe, rather than being just another dude in Brooklyn with a credit card and a subscription to Bon Appetit. Craig is preparing to leave her for his mistress, and Daisy hasn't been entirely honest with him either. In stylish prose, Sternberg constructs a lustrous domestic suspense novel, unfolding over the couple's week at the cabin in upstate New York. The house has a clawfoot tub, board games, and a porch facing a lake. It could be paradise, though the novel's flash-forward prologue shows paramedics arriving to remove two bodies from the property. As the tension escalates, the couple's decision to stay at the cabin may strain belief, but their willing entrapment plays off the novel's theme of commitment. Every morning, an envelope arrives with a question for the couple to discuss. The retreat's promise is 7 days, 7 questions, forever changed. The questions are suitably provocative. Would you change for me? Would you sacrifice for me? Would you die for me? Through the questions, Sternberg deftly folds a discussion of marital psychology inside a mystery plot. Daisy and Craig's marriage is laid bare from the banal, his running shoes stinking by the front door, her hair clogging the shower drain like some twisted sea creature, a tiny kraken, to the abstract. Why did their love curdle, and what might they do to each other next? The novel has an almost mid-century coolness and tone, and Daisy, an actor, is like a Hitchcock blonde, self-contained and enigmatic. Daisy was once a loudmouth theater kid, and why she turned herself into a cipher gives her story a raw, messy heart beating beneath all its layers of polished artifice. Before coming to the cabin, Daisy filmed a scene for a television thriller in which her character is shot through a car windshield. Capsules full of Vaseline and glitter are fired at the windshield, splattering on contact to convincingly simulate bullet holes in the glass. Similar moments of stagecraft and misdirection recur in The Eden Test, and the crisp dialogue has the intensity and compression of a stage play. After meeting the retreat's founders, a fiercely married older couple, Daisy says to Craig, "That could be us one day." "What, weirdo hippies living in the woods?" "No," says Daisy, happy. The Eden Test is deliciously entertaining, but its portrait of a marriage in trouble is nuanced and serious, hopeful and melancholy. There are real impacts under its glitter. This review was written by Flynn Berry, who is the author of Northern Spy, My Father's Brain by Sandeep Jauhar. My Father's Brain is a fascinating mixture of the medical and the personal. Jauhar, a cardiologist who has contributed to the New York Times, writes frankly about his difficulty separating out filial feeling when confronting his father's dementia. The Kingdoms of Savannah by George Dawes Green. When a high society matriarch in Savannah, Georgia, probes the murder of a bipolar young man, the secrets she uncovers run deep through both the city's waterlogged underground tunnels and its long history of racial injustice. Green's evocative novel shows how you can love a place's stink, find it splendid, even as you despise its sediment. Nights of Plague by Orhan Pamuk. In 1901, the half-Muslim, half-Christian population of the fictional Mediterranean island of Mingaria faces a deadly outbreak of bubonic plague. As the Ottoman Empire attempts to impose a quarantine, revolts and murder ensue. Pamuk, who was awarded the Nobel in 2006, interrogates both the course of history and the act of telling it. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.